be on my toes today. All weekend. This is only the first half of day one. Who knows?
You're going to be like a ballerina by the end of this. On your toes.
It's all good.
So about that mischievous little instruction that I adore so much of taking the two corners of your mouth and letting them grow apart from one another, aka smile. We know that the brain takes cues from the muscles of the face, right? Especially the eyes and especially the jaw. They send a signal to the brain about what's going on. And then the brain is going to release neurochemicals accordingly. And so Thich Nhat Hanh says, joy can be a cause for a smile, and a smile can be a cause for joy. Right? And that's biologically true, that when we smile, it's well established that it elicits serotonin and other feel-good chemicals that are released into the body. And then we also know from Dr. Rick Hansen, who wrote the book Hardwiring Happiness and the Buddha's Brain, really wonderful teacher if you are not familiar with him. But we know from his work that it takes around 10 to 15 seconds for a positive mental state to actually embed itself in what's called implicit memory storage or emotional memory storage. 10 to 15 seconds staying with a positive experience, something that feels good, something that's pleasant, something that's desirable, in order for it to leave a meaningful imprint on us. Which doesn't sound like a lot, but when was the last time you took a bite of delicious food or like took in a sunset and you just really stayed in the ah? Or about that long. I'll add in another note here as well that comes from the research of Daniel Kahneman, who wrote the book Thinking Fast and Slow, and is one of the more prominent psychologists on the planet right now, and he actually won a Nobel Prize for demonstrating at the biological level the way in which we devote way more resources to negative experiences than we do positive experiences. And part of his research is around what's called the observing self versus the experiencing self, right? And we have a self that is present viscerally and sensually for our experience, and then we have another self that is kind of overlaying that experience with a description or story, or thinking about what comes next, or thinking about what happened yesterday, or whatever. But that observing self is the self that remembers. And the observing self remembers things, remembers experiences according to how they ended, more than anything else about the experience. How something ends will determine how you perceive the memory of that more than anything else that happens. Ever, like, have a really nice, maybe a nice outing or a nice vacation or a nice meal, and something really crappy happens at the end of it, and it's very common to say, well, that just ruined the whole thing, right? That was so nice until that happened, and then it kind of takes the wind out of things. So we always want to end a meditation practice on a sweet note, right? Because then we're going to perceive our meditation as being perhaps a little better than it actually was, which is good because that will dovetail into a motivation to return to it. And then hopefully it'll dovetail into a motivation to return to my class as well. So, any questions, any other questions about what we've explored so far? Okay, yes, please. Tell us your name, please.
My name is Dan.
Okay.
I'm just curious, does it take as long?
Nope. No. We'll talk a lot about this, but so when we're in the presence of stressors, and which necessarily throws us back into the stress response, which is housed, if you will, in the lower two tiers of the brain, the reptilian brainstem and the mammalian midbrain. One thing about those regions of the brain is they have been around for a long, long time, because they existed in species that existed before humans. So the reptilian and mammalian brain have had eons to evolve, whereas the neocortex is more recently evolved, and no other species has it quite like human beings have it. Right. So the limbic system, where the stress response is sophisticated, lightning fast, efficient, doesn't eat up too much glucose, what your body runs on, right? Whereas the neocortex, which is where we know feeling states such as gratitude and empathy and a sense of values, a sense of who I am and what matters, sense of community, sense of connection to others, tenacity, being able to hold your seat in the face of pressure and temptation or anger. That's all the product of the neocortex, which is much slower, has had less time to evolve and to adapt. Eats up more glucose, can't process as much energy or as much information as quickly as the limbic system can. So one, we have negative experiences landing in a part of our brain that is a well-oiled machine and a dual processor. Two, when things are particularly threatening, what will happen is our contextual processing systems will shut down. The hippocampus, the parietal lobes, another region that I'm forgetting right now that's really important, but the parts of our brain that process the who, what, when, why, and where of our experience. Because if a car's coming at you and you're crossing the street, you don't have time to pontificate, right? Or like, I wonder if it really will hit me if I don't speed up. And I wonder how fast it's going. No, none of that context matters. What matters is car, me, gotta move, right? And so the stress response will bypass all of that contextual processing in the name of shaving nanoseconds off of our response, which could make the difference between life and death, right? So that means negative stuff that we experience comes right in, right in. It has less processing time, and it's again driven by a more efficient machine. So, to be happy, to be grateful, to have all of what's called the higher order emotional functions, which are of again the neocortex, compassion, tenacity, and so on. This is where mindfulness comes in, because we have to do them on purpose. There has to be an intention, right? Our default mode is actually stress. Right? And some chuckles, because we all know that's our lived experience. It agrees with our lived experience, right? Gratitude, empathy, and the rest, those are intentional mind states most of the time, unless you had a really excellent childhood, which I did not. So for me, it has to be intentional every time. I saw a hand up over here. Yes, please.
Do you think that's like good or bad that we...
I didn't know we had the microphone. Sorry. I will be aware of that. Yeah, yeah. Can you just repeat that again?
I was just wondering whether you think it's good or bad, or even helpful to us, like psychology, evolutionary, that we put more energy and thought into negative information rather than positive information, and just your thoughts on that.
Yeah, yeah. Good question. Well, first of all, it's the way it is. It's just how it is, right? So good or bad, in a way, almost doesn't matter, right? It's just the way it is, whether we like it or not. We're not going to change how we're hardwired. It is born of evolution. To go back to the work of Rick Hansen, we are more pessimistically oriented as a species. This comes directly from him, almost verbatim. You know, if you think about being back in hunter-gatherer times, which really our brains and bodies are, societal evolution has moved so quickly, especially in the last, I mean, we've only had these since Obama. And how quickly have things changed? And before that, we had the Industrial Revolution, and that ramped things up. But before the Industrial Revolution, society plodded along quite slowly in terms of evolution. Biological evolution is moving at a snail's pace, eons, you know, or rather generations for a gene to mutate just a little bit. So if we think back to hunter-gatherer times, we're out in the bush, we're looking for lunch, right? There's a bush over here, and there's a rustle in the leaves that I hear. And that rustle could mean one of two things, wind or predator. If I'm optimistic, I'll say, let's start with pessimistic. If I'm pessimistic, and I say, oh, that's definitely a predator, and I get out of there, let's say I'm wrong, no big deal. If I'm optimistic, and I say, yeah, that's just probably just the wind, and it's a predator, lights out. I'm lunch. Right? And I don't survive to pass on my genes. That's the important part. So, like it or not, the genes that we have inherited tend to be more pessimistic in nature. Now, I believe very strongly that there is nothing wrong with any of us. That every aspect of our being serves some kind of purpose. Each of us are an ecosystem. And in an ecosystem, everything serves a purpose. Nothing is out of place. Of course, there are exceptions to that rule. But if you think about it, in an ecosystem, even leaves dying and falling to the ground go to nourish the soil beneath, right? There might be horrible, violent winds, but those winds are scattering seeds far away from that tree to other regions where those seeds might have a chance to take root without eating up the nutrients that this tree, the original tree, needed. Right? And even predators unknowingly, unwittingly, regulate the populations of those that they prey on. Right? So, same thing with us. Everything about us serves some kind of purpose. And if we look for it, it's there. And so, I believe that this propensity serves a purpose. And I'm going to leave that one hanging, and I have time for one more, and then we've got to move. So actually, we'll do one and one, and then we'll have to move on. But yes, please. Oh, we'll wait for the microphone. Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Of course.
Thank you for coming to Spirit Rock.
Yeah.
My name is Alice, and if I misunderstood what you said during the meditation, please correct me, but I thought I heard you say that the body stores an emotional life that we have not lived, and I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on that. I'm not really sure what you meant. I mean, I'm thinking stress, but that's a curious way to word that, if that's what you meant.
I'm going to hold on to that question, because tomorrow we're going to unpack that. It's a very...
Thank you.
Yeah, we're going to unpack that, and there's really a lot there. There's really a lot there. We're just getting warm.
So I know, you know, in the next few days you'll be teaching techniques, but I'm just wondering, for the people of humanity who were not raised with the pristine ideal parenting, what would be the you know, amount of time that would we could hope that we might be able to change into a natural state of gratitude, et cetera. And not in terms of technique exactly, but what would that necessarily look like, that evolution? You know, because sometimes it's good to know what to try to manifest or strive for.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like I'm in my therapist's chair, and this is our first session. You're just like, how long before this doesn't hurt anymore, and how much as well, right? Yeah, that's a wonderful question, and I'm afraid it will be left a question because it's different for each of us, you know?
Well, sure, everybody's individual, but so what might the kind of, and of course everybody's individual, but you are also giving broad statements. So in a broad context, what might the evolution of an internal subconscious state of mind, how might that evolve from, you know, all this, all that, to one of peace and equanimity and all these other things?
So, it really depends. It really depends. It depends on what you took in. It depends on how much you took in. It depends on your temperament that you were born with. It depends on how the things that you took in were reinforced or maybe dissolved along the way. It depends on the kind of work that you're doing with yourself, therapy, meditation, yoga, self-care, etc. It depends on the earnestness with which you engage, the frequency with which you engage. A lot of variables, a lot of moving parts here. I will tell you that when I finally got serious, I'll just speak from my perspective because that's the only one I can truly know. What happened to me in childhood was not that bad, but I was born with a super sensitive temperament, and the way in which the things I took in was reinforced in quite atrocious ways. And so I left childhood pretty torn up. And I will tell you that when I got serious around 2005, when I landed at Walden House for 6 months, the one of the first things I discovered, my therapist called it repressed happiness. When I got clean and when I was willing to try some antidepressants for the first time, and I had a good therapist, and I had good community, and I had a meditation practice, and I had a yoga practice, and all of the things, a different way of being did come quite naturally. The life of... I want to leave that one right there for right now.
Thank you.
Yeah. Actually, I'll say one more thing, because there is... Welcome to my world. There is a tension. There is a tension between these two points. Point one is the one I've already made, that the life of the higher order emotional functions, the life of the neocortex, is an intentional one. But check this out. Here's the paradox. Our very nature is love. The way we were born was love. Think about babies for a moment. Think about newborn babies and how they come into this world. Buddha nature, divine nature. You want to see God, look into the eyes of a child, man. You know, we come into the world full of love. We come into the world full of joy. We come into the world hardwired for empathy, right? We have facial recognition software already running, and we can read the six major emotions on the face of a caregiver. And we were born able to read, you know, happiness, fear, worry, anger, etc., on the faces of the people around us, because that was our only indication of what was actually going on in the environment. So we were born with an ability to feel into other people's feelings. We were also born vulnerable and with a definite need to be protected and nourished. And that's where the trouble began. But from a different vantage point, one could say that if we were to undo all of the tangles of hurt and fear and stress and on and on and on that we have encountered and absorbed in this world, what we would be left with is that original nature of joy and love. So Marianne Williamson says, love is what we're born with, fear is what we learned here. So I was listening to a talk by Reggie Ray last night, actually, and he talked about how before we can be ready for any sort of foundational path of spiritual practice, we really need to be held in the cradle of loving kindness, which is the words of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, the first Tibetan Lama to teach to Westerners in the U.S., to place the heart of fearfulness in the cradle of loving kindness. We need to feel held, and that is why we start laying on the earth, right? Laying on the original mother, if you will. Right, because so many of us don't receive the cradle of loving kindness growing up, and so to have a chance to work with our bodies and to relax them into the earth and feel the way directly, viscerally, the way in which the earth is always holding us and always supporting us, right? Even the force of gravity, like I said during the meditation, is pulling tension away from our body. And interestingly enough, it's the force of gravity that's allowing us to sit here, that will allow us to get up and walk and run and dance and play as well, so that we don't float away is what makes all of those things possible. So there is a love, we could say, to the earth that we can begin to tap into through relating to the earth. The result, Reggie was saying, of not receiving loving kindness at the onset of life is dissociation. Right? We check out. And dissociation has two forms. Right? There's the way we ordinarily think of it, which would be more towards repression. But there's also the dissociation of indulging something. When we indulge our anger and we go into it, don't we lose consciousness and we say all kinds of things we ordinarily wouldn't say? Right, that's a form of dissociation as well. So part of our meditation practice is really reclaiming that loving kindness and really finding a way to give it to ourselves and to receive it from the earth, from the environment around us. Right. So there's the stress of everything that we take in. Right? And then there's the stress and that we hold, that we can't process as children. Again, we'll unpack this way more tomorrow, but as children, there's no way the love and joy that we were born with can handle bullying, you know, or an abusive parent or a neglective parent or an encroaching parent and the stress and the hurt that comes with that. There's no way. Right. So there's that stuff, the unfinished business that sits in our systems, literally sits in our nervous systems. Right. And then there's just the stresses of day-to-day life, modern-day life that we are not built for. And oh my God, it is getting more and more complex all the time. The number of apps that I have to keep up with, Jesse, right, like it used to be just the landline, and if you weren't home, you just weren't home. If nobody knew where you were, they just kind of assumed you would show up later, you know? And then it was email, and then it was text messages, and now it's like, you know, the email, the text messages, the Facebook Messenger, the Instagram DM, if you use Snapchat, if you're on Tinder, OkCupid, Bumble, you know, like it goes on and on. That's just being accountable to responding to people, keeping up with that, right? Because that's the other thing. Remember when it was okay to send an email like in a day or two? Yeah. Now it's like if you don't send it within an hour, people are like, "What's going on?" I was arranging a phone call with a journalist a couple of days ago. And we had set up a time. I hadn't confirmed it yet. I was like back to back with clients. And then I got an email from him that just said, bumping this. And I wrote him back, and I was like, what, are you saying you don't want to do the interview now? What does this mean? And he says, no, I'm bumping it to the top of your inbox. I was like, what a technique. Okay, I'm going to use that. It was very stressful, very stressful. Every time this thing buzzes in your pocket, that is a spike of adrenaline, a little mini spike of adrenaline, isn't it? Don't you feel that when you hear the little ding? There's a little wave, there's a little activation of your adrenal glands that goes on. And, you know, that's putting your body on a subtle, like, stress response roller coaster all day, every day, 7 days a week, 365 a year, after year after year. It adds up. It adds up. And what, there's some really interesting research that's happening in Canada. I can't remember the name of the doctor right now, on cancer. And on cancer, and it's linked to what the myofascial layer of our bodies, which is the connective tissue that is between your skin and your muscles. And what they are finding, actually, Dr. Langevin and her cohort, what they're finding is that there's a correlation between tissue stiffness and tumor growth. And what tissue stiffness is about is at the cellular level, right? Each of your cells are really sentient beings, right? They know who they are and where they are in your body and what their function is. And your cells actually have an awareness of what the functions of the cells around them are and what they need to do to interact coherently with those cells. Right? The whole life going on in each of your trillions of cells that we know nothing about. Right? But what happens is when a cell is stressed enough, it starts to forget, we could say, what its function is. It starts to forget who it is. It starts to forget how to communicate with the cells around us. And when that state of forgetting becomes radical, that's what we call a cancerous cell. So the stresses of our lives, you know, as above, so below, as within, so without. So we live in a kaleidoscopic kind of situation. So it's true for ourselves, but it's true for us as people. That when the stress in our lives, isn't it, gets so great, we forget who we are. We forget what our function is. We forget what matters to us. We do all kinds of crazy things, right? And we disconnect, we dissociate. And the whole intention behind the Recovering Wholeness title of this retreat is it's really about reconnecting. We've become so disparate and such strangers to the most primary aspects of our being, right? The earth. Do I even have to unpack that? When was the last time you had a conscious sense of I am connected to the earth, a conscious, wakeful feeling of connection to that which provides every bit of food and nourishment, hopefully, that goes into your body, right? That which is, you know, giving life to the flora around you, that is regulating the gases in the atmosphere so that you can breathe, right? We've become so disconnected from the earth. And I mean, the natural disasters, I don't want to bring up really terrible, triggering stuff right away, but I mean, everything that we are reading about, from the fires in Canada to, you know, what just happened in Puerto Rico, everything that we're seeing right now carries the tagline of the worst in a century, the worst on record, the worst in a decade, unprecedented. And it's like, whoa. That's the result of our sense of disconnection. I got into an argument, debate, with somebody on Facebook who I said something about, you know, the earth is speaking to us. She is letting us know we are off the mark in a big way. and somebody got on my case about anthropomorphizing the earth as a living being, you know, and like went down that rabbit hole. And, you know, and I was right, so I'll only tell you about my side of the debate. And that is that I think it's our lack of considering the earth as a living being that has led us down this path. Because if we were to acknowledge the earth as a living other who is sovereign, has a life of her own, or their own, we don't really know, but go with gender neutral, but right, a life of its own and feelings, sentience, right? You know, if we were to really consider that to be true, then we would consider the emotional impact we're creating with, you know, throwing a piece of garbage on the ground or fracking, right? That there's an emotional impact on the earth. We are laying stress upon the earth. She's forgetting the natural order of things, and it's becoming a cancerous situation. Our bodies. How many of us live from the neck up, ensconced in circling thoughts all day, all night, right? And the havoc that wreaks on upon our lives is we can't be present. We cannot be present. To be present is to be in your body, is to have a sense of, a visceral sense of embodiment, period. You can pay attention to the breath at the tip of the nose all you like, but if you're, unless you're absorbed in the tip of the nose, you know, you're not really here. And by the way, the tip of your nose is the body, you know. But how many of us live out of touch with our bodies? We only think about this thing when it's what? Time to eat, time to go to the bathroom, time to have sex, etc. Right? Or, you know, when we're tired, just throw some more coffee in that thing, right? Got too much work to do? Just don't sleep, right? Again, objectification is central to our dissociation. We objectify the body when the truth is it is a living other. We just established that it's filled with trillions of living others called ourselves. Fun fact, I think it's 0.02% of your total body weight on average is actually parasites. Everybody's got them. So your body is actually also made of other bodies, literally, you know. But the body as a living other that has sovereign, has a life of its own, that definitely feels things, and we treat it like an it. We treat it like it's a machine. That it's just here to for us to manipulate and kind of plunder, like we have the earth for our own for whatever we think is important, right? Not honoring that, as Nietzsche said, the body has more wisdom than your deepest philosophy. Which the Buddha said, the whole of the Dharma can be found in the body as well. So Nietzsche and the Buddha actually agreed. So then the next most primary aspect of ourselves, I would say, is the breath. Right? No breath, no life. The breath has a life of its own. The breath has a life of its own. It's going and going without us all day, every day. And then we step to connecting with it in meditation. But how many of you have noticed that when you go to do a breathing meditation, that all of a sudden you want to control the breath? Oh, I'm not breathing deep enough. And breathing deep is a spiritual breath, so I better do the spiritual breathing. Right? And we start to kind of manhandle the breath and like pushing and pulling on it, as opposed to allowing its natural rhythm, right? Allowing its natural intelligence to just unfold. And the thing about the breath is, and again, we'll talk more about this, but the thing about the breath is that it is the one function of the body that is either automatic or voluntary. Right? And so we can use the voluntary function of it to impact the automatic function of it. So the way that we treat it when we're working with it voluntarily will impact the way that it acts on its own. And the breath is connected to the nervous system. So we can literally rewire the nervous system through the breath. And we can do breath work practices like we just explored together, and that's one way of rewiring the nervous system. There's another way entirely called take your hands off the steering wheel and learn what it is to allow it to be in its natural rhythm. Allow it to sort itself out. When the breath sorts itself out, nervous system sorts itself out, we calm down. We calm down, we remember who we are, connection becomes available. And then there's our emotions. Oh no. Right. Perhaps the most baffling, bewildering aspect of ourselves. Freud said that we have affect phobia. We live in fear of our emotional lives. Right. The emotional lives we haven't been allowed to live. Right. Our emotions have lives of their own. Our emotions are living energies. We can get very, and we will get very specific with this, but how many of us live in such a way that we just shut down our emotions, you know? Loneliness pops up, you know, for me around 10 o'clock at night. Why am I single? You know? And my habitual response is, not today, we're watching Netflix. Right? We all do it in so many different ways. Anything that is, you know, like here's pleasant, here's neutral, here's unpleasant, anything that just ticks over a little bit this way, we get so neurotic. How do we get back in the zone? I'm out of my comfort zone. I want to live in my comfort zone as if that were even possible. Right? So we shut down our emotions, and we all know that that has a link to cancer, right? And I'm using cancer to connote a state of radical disconnection, right? So we don't allow our lives, our emotions to have the life of their own. And then the most fundamental thing about ourselves, or the next most fundamental thing about ourselves is each other, right? Because you are, I am, period, you know? If y'all weren't in this room right now, I would feel pretty stupid giving this talk. Right? But our entire life is relationships, isn't it? Think about the last time you were really down low and you know, the shit was really hitting the fan. Would you have been able to get out of that situation without some help? You know. We disconnect from each other, and that has disastrous effects. We live in the story of me and only me, and that has disastrous effects on our lives. So it's my belief that all of this correlates to the second noble truth in Buddhism. Right? We have the first noble truth, that there is suffering, that suffering exists, it seems to be universal, it seems to be bound up with, you know, the natural experience of what it is to be alive, you know, and then the second noble truth is, well, it has a cause, you know, which gives way to, you know, that's the beginning of the Buddha sprinkling some hope on the first noble truth. Well, okay, that's not the end of the story, that it's all suffering. And the cause is somebody, anybody? Cause of suffering, second noble truth. We're here at Spirit Rock. Grasping. Tightness, tension, right? We spent a good half an hour in our bodies undoing grasping, tension, right? Wanting it to be some way that it isn't already, right? And really, I think that the origin of grasping, of thirst, of clinging, of neurotically saying, no, it can't be this way, yes, it must be this way, right? Isn't it when we get what we don't want, it's how do I get rid of that? And when we get what we want, it's how do I make sure this never goes away? Right? And the origin of all of that clinging, I think, is this lost connection. The fact that we feel like islands so much of the time. We are on our own, struggling through this thing called life with all of its ebbs and flows, trying to hold it together and not able to just relax and to open and remember who we are and remember that the truth is we're never not connected. How would it be possible? It's all an illusion. It's all Maya, as the Vedic folks would say. It's all an illusion that we could ever be disconnected. How could we actually fundamentally be disconnected from the earth, disconnected from our bodies, disconnected from each other? Not actually possible. So the good news is disconnection, the notion that we are somehow not whole, is an illusion. It's not real. It's just us forgetting. Right? So we long. When we feel disconnected, we long. There's a deep longing in each of us. Right? And the thing about that longing is it's a longing for lost connection, and we're not taught that. We go to school and we learn so many things about the body, but we learn nothing about embodiment. Right? We learn so many things about the wonders of the respiratory system, but we don't learn anything about how to use those wonders to impact our nervous system. We go to school and we learn something about psychology or emotions, right? But we don't learn how to live a really skillful emotional life. Right? We're not taught how to connect, and so we look in the wrong places. Looking for love in all the wrong places, right? That's my story. Because I have all of those apps. So interestingly enough, what we're arriving at is, by definition, yoga. Right? Yoga means whole, or to yoke, to reconnect, or to rather, if we don't lose our connection, then I think the more accurate thing to say would be we lose the experience of that connection, right? And we become disparate. And yoga means to bring what is disparate together into integration. Right? In the Yoga Sutras, in the first chapter, very famous verse, yoga's chitti vritti nirodha. Right, which means that the goal of yoga, this is interpreted in all kinds of ways, right, is to stop the turnings of the mind. Chitta means mind, vritti means turning. So our chitta is being vrittying all the time, right? And we talk about how the mind spins and how thoughts go in circles. And in Buddhism and in Vedic religion, we talk about samsara being this cycle of suffering. You know, and this all correlates to the turning of the mind. And I take that very literally. We have turned it around and we've gotten it exactly backwards, 180 degrees backwards, how to live life. Our habits are 180% in the wrong direction, or 80 degrees rather, in the wrong direction. And meditation, actually, if you look at the entire canon of Buddhist meditation, it is always about taking that which is habitual and turning it on its head. So in mindful presence, right, our habit is to be scattered all over the place, ADD, 24/7. And we say, now bring that in. Just be here. Keep it really simple. No multitasking, just this breath. In loving kindness meditation, we take the habit of wanting the good stuff for ourselves, like clinging to the good for ourselves. We say, no, let's give that away. Right? Let's give that away. Can others be happy? Can others be free? Right? And then in compassion meditation, right? Ordinarily, we run from pain. We say, no, that's wrong. If I feel that pain, whoosh. All right, nobody, like, get really sympathetic or tell me you're sorry for my loss, but because I'm good. But my sister recently died. And I spoke at her memorial last week. And, you know, it's just the culture that my family has internalized that to really freak out over this tremendous loss we all suffered, it's like a failure. It was wrong somehow. Be strong. Be strong through this. May you be strong through this, as in, may you not feel. And there are moments of people in my family kind of losing it, and there is moments of other family members going, ah, she's always in crisis. It's always something with her. And it's like, what? So we run from pain at all costs. And compassion meditation, which I think correlates to processing our own traumas, I think that's where it really begins, says, that pain, I'm interested in it. I'm curious about it. What does it have to show me? What needs to be felt here, as uncomfortable as it is? And the thing with all of these three trainings that turn things around kind of in the right direction, if you will, is we feel better when we do them. Right? Our habit is saying be scattered, be selfish, run from pain, and then we can't sleep at night, right? Or we lose our sense of direction in life. And then when we reverse the habit through each of the families of meditation, which we'll be exploring all three in this retreat, we find that we reconnect, we start to relax, we start to open up, we start to remember who we are, what our deeper nature is, that which belies all of these surface layers of hurt and fear and tension and so on. Right? We start to make contact with that deeper nature. And then we start to have the life that we really want. Not the life that we think that we want, but the life that we're really meant to have. So, if we're going to elect to go on that trip, it's going to be difficult. We're going to face difficulty. If you're going to elect to give away joy and to face pain, it's going to be difficult. And over the course of these 3 days, difficult things are going to come up, period. And that's not wrong, that's not bad, that's not me doing a terrible job. And it's really, really important that we know how to be with difficulty. So I want to lay a little bit of groundwork here. In any situation in which we find ourselves faced with difficulty, it is never wise to just kind of kamikaze into that feeling state and let it rip through you unconsciously. What we need to do is we need to learn how to hold our experience. Again, place the heart of fearfulness in the cradle of loving kindness. So a very famous psychoanalyst and theorist, Dee Winnicott, has this concept of the holding environment. Holding environment, by definition, I think it's on your handout somewhere, maybe on the first page. They're two-sided pages, so I believe it's on the first page, but I don't have one. Actually, could somebody pass up a handout? Thank you. But now you don't have one. It's okay. I'll be all right. So find the definition of holding environment, please. And you'll see that what it means is It's a space that's infused with caring. Ah, thank you so much, Jim. It's a space that's infused with caring. Why? So that difficulties can emerge. Oh, it's actually towards the back. Way towards the back. This was going to come later, but I think it needs to be here earlier. Right? Interestingly enough, so space infused with the energy of caring, of warmth, of loving kindness, so that difficulty can emerge and be met there, so that we're not just bashing our way into grief or whatever. And what Winnicott was referring to was the space, the metaphoric space in the therapy room, or the metaphoric space between a therapist and client, that's a space that it's the therapist's job to, in so many different ways, open their heart and create an atmosphere of caring, not just through facial expressions or, you know, actually feeling caring, but in the way that the room is set up, in the timeliness of the session, all of the things that frame the session, in the deep listening that ideally will go on, which is such a special thing. How many of us get to receive somebody just undivided attention, you know, throughout the course of one day or one week or one year, to really be listened to is a special thing. One of my favorite stories isn't even my own story. It's a story told by my colleague Joe Mauricio, who's a teacher in the Shambhala tradition, and his teacher is Pema Chodron, who I assume some of you might know of, kind of a very sassy Buddhist nun who's written a lot about working with difficulty. And so the story goes that Joe was walking down 6th Avenue in Manhattan, and he was completely absorbed in a problem a friend of his was having. He had just left seeing a friend who was having this tremendously difficult time, and he was just, you know, really stuck with, well, how can I help this person? You know, the situation seems so fraught, I feel so powerless, all of these things are happening for them, I really want to help. And he looks up, and he sees Pema Chodron and her entourage in their monk's robes walking into Duane Reade. And he's like, you have a problem, and you see your teacher, you see the guru on the street, you go and you ask their advice, right? So he runs up to Pema, and, you know, and he's got this, like, harried look on his face. She instantly reads him. And before he can say anything, she says, hey, Joe, it's really nice to see you. I gotta go, but just remember, the best thing you can do for anyone is to be truly present for them. And then she disappears into the pharmacy. Right. That's a holding environment, to be truly present, to receive somebody. It's so rare, so special to receive that. Right. So a holding, this concept of the holding environment is analogous to all kinds of other situations. You know, how we enact an intimate relationship can be a holding environment, right? The space of this room and the way that I'm holding space, right, needs to be a holding environment. I'm giving myself a friendly reminder. The way that we hold space for each other, the way that we show up in this room, and the way that we engage in our practice, and the way that we handle our body, speech, and mind in this room makes a difference. Can we come from a place of caring? Can we contribute to a holding environment? The space of meditation, holding environment, right? Anything that has a form around it, like this room, right? Like the space between me and you, right? Can be a holding environment, and meditation has a form around it, right? There's a posture to it, there's a technique to it, there's a process to it, there's instructions on how to work with what comes up. Holding environment. So the way that we work with our emotions and the way that we work with difficult things that come up, that will certainly come up as we progress needs to be with an attitude of holding. Can we hold our experience? The interesting thing is, with difficulty, when we don't dissociate, when we simply hold, neither repressing, neither or indulging. Trouble with the English language today. But neither repressing or indulging, and we just middle path hold what is difficult. The interesting thing is, then the experience can move through us quicker. When we allow difficulty, when we just let it in and we allow its duration, we actually move through difficulty much quicker. It is the shortcut. Ajahn Chah says, there are two kinds of suffering in this world. There is the kind that you run from that follows you around everywhere, and there's the kind that you turn to face that opens the door. Right. So if we look to boy, who organized this thing? Ah. Right. If you look to, it's four pages from the back, you're going to see a little wave that says under the heading Urge Surfing. The nature of everything in material reality is this. Silence. There is a crest. And now we return to silence. Everything. This iPad, this body, this talk, or every meditation practice we do, every paper you wrote in college had a beginning, middle, and end. Everything works in this way. And that goes for our emotional lives as well. When we repress or indulge, we don't allow them to have their life. We choke it off. And then that just goes to sit in our bones and just, you know, like fumes from a radiator, right? That which we push underground, right, is informing our lives in ways we can't see. Just like a radiator, you can't see the heat rising off of it, but you can feel that the room is warm, right? So when we just allow things to come and knowing that they'll peak, and we can kind of hold our experience with care, then they fade out, and then we're done. This is the only true way to deal with addiction, by the way, that I've had to learn the hard way in my years, is to just allow the cravings, right? Just allow the fucking craving already, right? Even to bring this, you know, we don't have to talk about heroin, but we can talk about cigarettes, right? Something that's considered more innocuous that maybe more of us in this room either currently engage in or have in the past. No shame. But think about craving a cigarette. You want the craving to end, so you smoke it. But then that means that cravings are going to continue, right? Backwards. As opposed to, if you really want the craving to end, just sit. Do nothing. Hold it. Let it get intense. Let it bear into you. Same thing with grief. Same thing with anger. Same thing with anything that's difficult. Just let it come. Let it peak, and then watch it go.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. If you're indulging, but there are times when it's impossible not to, and you're exactly right. And thank you for saying that. There are times when the appropriate thing to do is to change the channel, right? If we can imagine a scale from 1 to 10 with 1 being total ease and 10 being panic attack, right? I would say, actually, this is the formula for levels 1 through 7. For like 8, 9, 10, it might be a good idea to do something else, right? But I will say that, yes, there are times when we might need to pull the covers over our head and just have the freak out, really indulge the emotion. But I'm speaking very generally, right? The more you can, and we all have our own subjective capacity for holding. We all, 7 is a subjective number. It's different for each of us, right? What that is. And over time, we can actually grow that capacity to hold difficulty, right? So that we can achieve upeksha, which is balance, right? Not being thrown off by the ebbs and flows, not swaying in the wind so much. Not that you don't feel anything, it's just that you start to have more space for it. Yes, please. Yeah, so very good question. So I'll answer this, and then we're going to have some practice so we can ground all of this nice theory in an experience. There are times when we need to suppress. And suppression is different than repression. Repression is saying, not today, not ever, if I can get away with it. Suppression is a more wakeful, more conscious behavior where we say, okay, this is what's going on and these are my feelings, and the reality is, you know, for me, a wave of grief over my sister, and the reality is I have 10 clients back to back today. I see it that it's right here. I'm putting it right here. I'm going to come back to that later. It's a muscle we have to grow, but it's entirely possible to say, I'm just setting this aside for right now. Yes, same thing. Yeah. Please.
My question was about. Meaningful pontifications, and they have so much meaning because the emotions are strong.
Mm-hmm.
What is your process through with those thoughts, then also?
Yeah, y'all came ready. I love it. I'm trying to ease into the emotional processing part, which we'll have a whole day of it tomorrow. Buckle your seatbelt. Right. But your question is basically, if I'm processing the emotion, will the stories in my head die down and the thoughts around? Yeah?
Yeah, and they seem so real, right? Whatever you're telling yourself, so it's very difficult to
yeah.
this real feeling or not, mm-hmm. real thought or not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yes, they go together. There's the stimuli, there's the emotional response, and then, I mean, this is how all emotions work, is there's stimuli in the environment, the body gets the feeling shoots up to the brain scans the environment for the most likely suspect, we focus in on that person or situation or whatever, and then we have what's called a full-blown emotion. And if we just knew how to go down to the body, like, okay, that story feels so real, but it's a fantasy. It's all a fantasy. If we just go down to the level of feeling, so much easier. It hurts, but it's so much easier than, you know, the added layer of narrative. And yes, when the feeling is what's giving rise to the thoughts, is giving rise to the narrative. So yeah, you get rid of the source and then the stories die. Simple but not easy. Let's practice. So come to a nice, upright, dignified posture. Yeah, if you need to stand for a moment or stretch your legs or do anything to situate yourself, we're only going to practice for 15 minutes. Lunch will be in about 2 hours. Thank you for getting that. Lunch. Lunch will be in 15 minutes at the end of this practice. Right, right, right. Dinner's at 11 p.m. And now that I've said that, everybody's going to think about lunch the whole time. This whole meditation will be a lunch meditation. And we'll hold that.
Vegetarian.
Thank you. So, upright, dignified posture. So, if you're sitting on a cushion, knees are at or below hip level. If you're sitting on a chair, both feet grounded on the floor, best as you can. And really, we want to start with the earth. So one, feel the feet. And if you're on a cushion on the ground, perhaps the shins and the knees. Just in contact with the earth. Connect. And then there's the pelvis. We really want the sitz bones to be falling into whatever we're sitting on. Really rooted. Like the two prongs of an electrical cord going into the socket. We want to plug into the earth through the sitz bones and the perineum as well, which is important to the energetic body. So find the sweet spot of the sitz bones where you can just really plug in, and where the torso is erect, perpendicular to the earth, and the weight of the torso is just landing squarely in that pelvis, helping it to connect even more. Please place your hands somewhere around mid-thigh. I prefer facing down, but if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But mid-thigh so that the collarbones are wide, the shoulders are balanced. And then the crown of the head lifts. So you can imagine a string coming from the crown of the head and a hand pulling up on that string. And the forehead tilts forward ever so slightly. And the chin tucks inwards ever so slightly to allow the back of the neck to be long. Eyes closed is good. Eyes open is just fine. If going inside is too anxiety inducing for you, that's fine. Please take care of yourself. Some of us just have a practice of working with the eyes open. But if eyes are open, gaze is lowered and diffuse. Just notice how you're feeling. What's it like to be in this body? And we'll just start taking some deep breaths. So just breathing in gently through the nose, and we'll exhale through the mouth with a little sound. We're just going to do this to trigger the parasympathetic nervous system, which is a fancy way of saying relax. And as you take these purposeful deep breaths down to the belly, filling up the chest and the shoulders, and just exhaling, once again, allow the face, the eyes, the jaw to soften. Let the shoulder tops and all the way down to the hands, let these get heavy and just melt. And over the course of these next few breaths, let the belly just relax. Legs, your seat, your feet. A softening. I want you to return to that sense of the whole body is breathing. Like when we were laying on the floor. As you breathe in, you just feel the body expand. As you breathe out, a gentle contraction. And notice, are you pushing and pulling the breath? Are you tensing the jaw, neck, and shoulders to inhale? Are you trying to breathe the right way? Oh. Try just letting the exhale do its own thing. And if that means it's super short, that's just fine. And then pause. Just wait and let the breath dissolve. And you'll wait until you get a clear signal from the body that it's time to inhale. And we want a very gentle inhale. You're really just assisting the inhale. And there's a slight pause at the top, a little shorter. And the next exhale just simply exits the body of its own accord. And then you wait. Really just let it go. And then you'll feel the gentle tug of the inhale. Allow it to come in. You'll feel when it's done. You allow the space at the top. The exhale's natural intelligence will take its course. Try this for some time. That gap after the exhale. Magnificent. The settling that's possible there. But you got to be present to really let it go. And you got to be present to feel the spark of life that wants to come. Yeah, the mind is doing its thing. There's stories, there's distractions. And then there's the sheer pleasure of the relaxed, poetic, smooth breath. So now we're going to keep the breath's natural rhythm. And I want you to hone in at the tip of the nose. So we're going from the full body and we're just narrowing in to the tip of the nose, the openings of the nostrils, the region above the upper lip, kind of this triangle shape right in the center of the face, where you can feel the cool and tingling of the inhale, the warmth and tingling of the exhale. You will want to set an intention to hold the breath, connect to the breath, and simply hold it. If it's too tight, you'll crush it. If it's too loose, it'll fly away. Just like if you were holding a bird. So, a big stupid grin to conclude, or maybe just a mischievous smirk. Hold. One final deep breath. And we'll conclude with a bow. Enjoy lunch, and I'll see you all back here at 1:30.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.